Welcome to the Air Force Doctrine Podcast. My name is Dave Lyle. For this episode, we're interviewing Lieutenant General Adrian Spain, who serves as the Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations Headquarters U.S. Air Force in the Pentagon. He leads the development and implementation of policy directly supporting global operations, force management, training, and readiness for the Air Force, and serves as the Air Force Operations Deputy to the Air Force Chief of Staff. The three new doctrine documents we'll be discussing with General Spain include Air Force Doctrine Publication 3-0 Operations, which is updated with core air power principles in the context of the competition continuum, renews focus on the Air Force's core functions and distinct capabilities while strengthening connections to joint operations. The second publication is Air Force Doctrine Publication 3-0.1, Command and Control, which supersedes Air Force Doctrine Publication 3-30. It includes entirely new content on the command and control function, matures our understanding of the mission command framework, and describes decentralized operations through distributed control. And the third document is Air Force Doctrine Publication 5-0 Planning, which introduces the Air Force planning process to equip airmen with tools to solve complex problems, empower units of action, and prepare for future joint planning. Lieutenant General Spain, welcome to the Air Force Doctrine Podcast. We're really grateful that you could join us here at the LeMay Center today.
Great to be here with you. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So as the Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations, among a building of many busy people, you're probably one of the busiest. We're especially grateful to hear that you're here to talk about basically the new doctrine release we just had a week ago, which Chief of Staff gave us a good memo and endorsement of this. It's our contribution to, as we're all following his lead, to reoptimize great power competition. We call them the big three here at the LeMay Center: operations, command and control, and planning doctrine documents. Thanks again to your staff who helped us work on these, especially with the operations and command and control. So right to the questions. In a recent meeting with our team, as you were helping with this, you said that these new doctrine publications are essential warfighting documents for all airmen, also echoed by the chief. Could you share your impressions on how these doctrine documents flow together and how they support the work you've been doing to reoptimize for great power competition?
Sure. I think even more foundationally, the documents help warfighters at all levels to contextualize what it is that we do as airmen and in the context of air power and what we offer to the joint force. I'm going to speak as plainly as I can and use terms that I understand and try to correlate some of the work that you all have done here with these doctrine documents into a warfighting language directly. And so our corollary to doctrine is 3-1 manuals, right, at the tactical level. And without the doctrine that explains how we intend to operate, how we intend to command and control, and how we intend to plan, we don't have a baseline of understanding for the entire force to deviate from, really. It's an understood foundational starting point with which to learn how we both implement and execute air power options for the joint force. And it becomes a foundational set of tools for airmen of all levels to understand how it is that we come to the decisions that we come to. And the more artfully they are practiced, the more you understand the assumptions and the nuances in each of the documents, the more you can tailor either the planning or the operations or the command and control to the situation. They're not intended to be cement anchors to airmen. They're intended to be a common reference point that allows us, frankly, to jump off when the conditions allow and demand. And we are all in tune to the way that the structure is designed so that you can anticipate next steps in operations. You can anticipate next steps in planning. You can anticipate next steps in command and control on behalf of a air component commander or on behalf of a joint force commander.
So I like that was the talk about the tools that you give, and the chief talked about the intellectual tools that are buried here give you a lot of flexibility, because we're finding that as the dynamics of competition change, we need a lot more flexibility, and we need to have, you know, those starting points. Like you said, the shorthands, so the ability to communicate both as airmen and with the joint force. We've always done planning in the context of higher headquarters, joint air tasking cycle, but now we're looking at planning pretty much across the force. And this gets to something you mentioned too about lowering the barriers of entry so the doctrine's success and relevant to all airmen at all levels, not just necessarily in the higher headquarters. Can you talk about changing that culture to bring that to pretty much all kinds of activities as things like Agile Combat Employment or ACE become the regular operating mode rather than something new?
Yeah, so these tie directly to the tasks that we've been given by the chief to reoptimize for great power competition in many, many, many different ways. And one of the key concepts that we are implementing is this idea of an ACE staff, right? Inside of our wing structure of our unit of action, an ACE staff that is designed and operates similarly to the numbered Air Force staff to the MAGCOM staff to the air staff to the joint staffs and combatant command staffs. There's a similarity in the lexicon when you have an A-STAP, but that's not the reason we made the change. The reason we made the change is I guarantee you at every wing in the world, and having been a wing commander a couple of times, the first thing we do as wing commanders is look around and go, hey, if I have a task, who do I give it to, right? It's not a perfect task for the ops group commander. It's not a perfect task for the maintenance group commander or the mission support group commander. It's not a perfect task for my DS or the functional administrative support staff up at the wing. Who do I give it to? Well, in our world today, we typically build a CAG or some other entity to give tasks to that don't neatly fit into a group or a squadron that can handle it, right? That knows how to take the task, how to do mission analysis, how to create options for a commander and recommendations for a commander and bring it back for decision. We have brute forced our way into tasking to group commanders who own a task and work on it the best they can while doing other many, many other things and getting their squadron commanders involved to help them with it and them getting their all-stars involved to help with it and then creating a product that ultimately works its way back up to the wing commander. Or you hand it to a CAG who was stolen from all of those same entities and put together for the sole purpose of integrated kinds of problems that exist in the wing that the wing commander wants to get after that they just don't have time to do. Well, the A-STAF is designed to provide those functions for our wing commander to take tasks, to receive orders from higher headquarters, to disseminate orders deliberately to subordinate units, to create recommendations and decisions, to run OPTs, to execute the joint planning process for air in a way that takes the nuances of the way that we tend to organize ourselves and problem solve, but also takes the best from the MDMP and from the JPE, right? And so what we don't want is a two-year planning cycle like the Army. What we don't want is a similarly scheduled planning cycle like our maritime brothers and sisters. What we want is a planning cycle that fits an airman's proclivities, right? And so we tend to want to move a little bit faster. We also tend to not like to write things down generally. And so this A-STAF is a way of getting out of MFRs and info notes and getting into orders and processes and recommendations and mission analysis and suitable and feasible options for commanders that they don't have to go build a team that is going to go do this for them. The A-STAF then takes these processes that we've written down in these doctrine documents, and that's a starting point that we train them to execute to. Hey, these are the outputs that we want in operations in C2 as a subset of operations. And then here's the way that we want to organize ourselves to plan around problems and to do the things that the commander needs done in a deliberate way and that fully supports the outcomes that they want to execute. So that's one small example of how the changes that we're making structurally to the unit of action inside the Air Force are paired directly to the doctrine documents. The reason why this planning one in particular is so important, it will give everyone who goes onto these staffs a baseline of understanding of not just what the planning process is, but how to do it. And then we have paired with other training courses that Air University offers and that you can find in AOC training or in the 505th, these courses that build off of that foundational doctrine and make it operational. And now instead of us as majors and lieutenant colonels going to joint staffs or in combatant command staffs, learning for the first time how to do some of this stuff, it becomes a part of our vernacular and it allows us to participate in the joint discourse in a different way and with a little bit more credibility than potentially we have in the past.
So as the Deputy Chief of Staff for Operations, you're tracking all kinds of things going on in the war right now in a very rapidly changing character of warfare, as we usually talk about. So how would you say air power has evolved considering the recent lessons learned from regional conflicts in places like Israel, Ukraine, Syria, and elsewhere?
It's interesting. Having been at UCOM at the start of Russia's war on Ukraine and Ukraine's fight against Russia, we noticed something right away on both sides, right? Neither could establish air superiority. And from that, you watch the fight devolve into effectively a longer range trench warfare because your artillery pieces can go further. We've also seen, because of this lack of air superiority, a rise of other technologies that are equally mobile in that space when there is a lack of contestation from the air that is persistent. So we certainly have lessons to learn from the Ukraine war. We need to also understand that Russia would fight a war against the United States or against NATO much differently than they would fight against Ukraine. Some aspects are similar, some aspects are different. They wouldn't hold in reserve any capabilities across all of the domains. The tenets of air power haven't really changed in my mind. The necessity for air superiority, whether episodic or persistent, still exists. It may be that we have to achieve it in slightly different ways because the technologies are different, but gaining it is a necessity for joint warfare to avoid being in the fight that we're seeing play out inside of Ukraine today, where neither can establish air superiority. Therefore, we either have ground forces clashing and stalemating or giving slight ground on either side, one direction or another. And then eventually the team with the most mass wins and can accept the most losses wins. Air power is decisive in that environment. Despite the rise of the drone, the small UASs, the reason that they're so effective is that you have ground troops that are so close to the forward line that are unimpeded by air power and interdiction capabilities. And so if Ukraine had been able to establish air superiority, or if Russia had been able to establish air superiority, the necessity for the tit for tat in the small UAS space would have diminished because you wouldn't have the people there to execute the drone maneuver warfare at the scale that we have right now, because they would be targets for high-flying precision air power that had a persistent presence. Those are all targets that a modern Western Air Force would be able to take out and change the character of the fight from the outset. And so we have to remember that whatever conflict we get into and whatever the changing character of the warfare, that the tenets remain the same, and that the necessity for air superiority to enable the joint fight and to be decisive in enabling the joint fight to progress is paramount.
Some commenters say that, hey, the future is what we're seeing in Ukraine, or things like this, the unmanned, the drones and all stuff. But it's also, I've seen one of the counters to that is, that's not what China thinks. Look what they've just been revealing lately. They obviously seem to think that there's going to be a long future for aircraft with air crew in them as well. How has that changed, I think, about the balance of the force? And this gets into the one force design that we're working on more on the General Harris side. But what are your impressions of what do you think that mix will look like in the near future and as we look out further out?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. You know, I think there's still a role for manned aircraft, and you know, warfare is inevitably a human endeavor at the end of the day. And so even our, air quoting, unmanned aerial systems of today and of the past have actually been very highly manned. The manning has just been disaggregated from the platform, but requires lots of manpower to be able to implement and execute. And so I don't really see that changing in the near term. You know, the F-35 we're going to be buying for a number of years, so that's a manned platform. If there's a penetrating counter-air platform, certainly there'll be discussions about whether that should be manned or unmanned. But I see a role for a manned future air superiority platform that is intended to win in the environments that we're talking about, as much as a protected, networked, fully censored, kitted out unmanned platform. I mean, that could be the case as well. But you have to ensure that the networking is robust enough, or that the autonomy is robust enough and trusted enough if you're going to go unmanned. It's going to be contested the entire way. And if you don't have a human in the platform that can make decisions when all of the systems are blocked or contested or degraded or spooked, that's a risk calculus. And do we want the option to have the human to make a right decision in those spaces? I believe that we do, and we just have to make the case for that. Small UASs, I think, provide one-way attack kind of capabilities, provide unique opportunities for the air component commander. You know, we certainly have traditionally viewed ourselves and tied ourselves to platforms that take off from runways generally. Well, what if we're not limited to that any longer? What if I can do air interdiction from the air via a platform that also launches from the ground, but in a slightly different model, right? In a way that doesn't require a runway nearby or at all, in a mass that I can't get to in an exquisite $100 million airplane that helps to enable a persistent fight and persistent air superiority or episodic air superiority. I don't think that what we're learning in Ukraine is a substitute for what we have learned since the inception of the Air Force in 1947. I think it is an addition to and will augment the way that we achieve air superiority in the future, but I don't believe it is a standalone lesson that we must pivot 100% to that new technology. Eventually, until batteries have deeper capacity, until networks are more robust, until jamming is countered completely, every 100% bet that we make on a technology is fraught with peril. So we need a layering of what I would call traditional Air Force capabilities and platforms to a degree, augmented by the technology of the day to make those more exquisite weapons and more exquisite platforms much more effective over time and in the battle spaces that are most highly contested.
So one of the things that the new operations doctrine talks about is a crosswalk of air power contributions to the competition continuum discussed in Joint Pub 3-0. Part of one of the reasons we're trying to get this out is to help airmen understand what we mean by competition. What have you seen talking to airmen about how they understand it, and what would you like them to take away from both the document and as we move forward?
Yeah, I think it's a good point that competition means different things to different people. And I think that the doctrine really does a pretty good job of laying out what the auspices of competition across the continuum look like, and to be deliberate about where you are in the continuum and what that means for you, and at what level, right? And so is at the wing level, are you in competition with the PRC at the wing level? You could say yes. Is your guidance as a wing commander going to be the competitive thing that wins against the PRC in competition as we look to deter the PRC and Russia? Yeah, maybe not, right? Because those wing commanders are working for a air component commander, typically, that is working for a combatant commander, typically, or a joint force commander, typically. And the competition that we're describing is really between nations. And we all have a role to play in competition, but deciding at a subordinate level of how you are going to compete is probably going to be misaligned with the broader picture. And so we need to be able to understand not just the continuum of competition and what that means from an activity perspective, but the continuum of competition from a who owns the authority to drive our competition in a particular AOR. And typically that's a combatant commander at the pleasure of the Secretary of Defense, at the pleasure of the President. So the nation is in a competition. As an aside, you know, Simon Sinek has a great book called The Infinite Game. And in an infinite game, there are no winners and losers. There are only players. You get to make choices to stay in the game. And that's the goal. It isn't winning. You don't win in an infinite game in the typical manner of speaking. And in competition, this feels a lot like an infinite game. You know, we are competing against ideologies and forms of government, and we've got to stay in the game and stay ahead. And also in that book, he talks about staying core to your strengths, right? Staying true to your core strengths. And, you know, we shouldn't compete as if we need to be like anyone else. We should compete based on the values and integrity that we have and the core strengths that the United States as a nation has, and stay in the game and do those things that allow us to propagate this form of government and our nation and our values for as long as possible. And competition, when kind of framed in that context, takes on a little bit different meaning.
So I like how you put that, because it also blends well with one of our professors, Dr. Everett Dolman, as he talked about, and also the infinite game from James Carse, the original idea of Dr. Dolman would talk about strategy being a plan for continuing advantage and the strengths we bring to it, and both the way we do organize our concepts, the technologies that you talked about we're investing in. And then the next one is the organization. So this, and I know this is your bread and butter with AFWERGEN. Can you talk about the changes that the Air Force has been doing to basically reoptimize for air power competition? And I know you've been talking to groups around there, and you talked to a lot of our students and spouses and commanders. Thank you for that today. But can you talk about the differences between force generation and force presentation and how that's going to affect our future airmen, including the airmen who will be leading these changes as we reoptimize? The idea that you have to do structure a certain way to be more competitive.
Yeah. Yeah. Thanks for the question. Force generation is the business of readying and generating capable forces to be employed, right? So whether that's as low as a 1 week spin up to prepare for a thing, that's generation of a capability to your AFWERGEN cycle. And our force generation model has evolved to be the Air Force force generation model, which is based on a 24-month, four-phase cycle, 6 months apiece, starting with a reset phase, going to a prepare phase, a certify phase, and then an available phase. And when we are intending for the force to be employed by someone, we are generating the force to be employed and presented at a certain point. Force presentation is what is the structure of the thing that we are giving to be employed. What does that look like? For the last 30 years or so, our structure has been really a squadron or individuals, UTCs, lots of and lots and lots of UTCs. outside of operational squadrons or individual aircraft in mobility sense or PR sense or special ops senses in certain cases. And so we kind of had pulled ourselves apart over the last 30 years outside of the Cold War when the wall went down, because that's what was expected and required of the Air Force at the time. I didn't need a wing to go deploy. I needed a 12-ship of fighters. I needed a 4-ship of C-17s. I needed an 8-ship of tankers. I didn't need the whole wing of tankers to be in that place. And I needed them for a short stint, and then I wanted them to go back. Well, it turns out the short stint is 30 years, 6 months at a time in the Middle East. And so we still remain over there, but the needs of the day ebb and flow in CENTCOM. And if you haven't been in AFCENT in a month or so, you don't really know what's going on in AFCENT because it changes so quickly. And so the demands are all over the place. And that was perfectly suited for the last strategic environment. Permissive bases, not really under any duress, certainly under attack once in a while, but not in a way that was existential to the power projection platform. And so I could bring in forces that were minimally trained. They could fall in on an existing structure that was very familiar to what they left and keep making the donuts. I could do that forever. Now, the risk of doing that is borne out by the forces that are not deployed, right? And we took very small chunks of all of the forces, all the squadrons and wings, and combined them together to meet up inside of the rotational requirement. And because we did it that way, we couldn't really articulate risk very well as an Air Force, which didn't help us when we were talking about risk acceptance with the Joint Staff and with the Secretary of Defense, because we had pulled ourselves apart to the degree that we knew that it was painful. We just couldn't articulate how painful it was. I knew that something might break soon, but I couldn't tell you exactly what might break and when and how and what impact that would have if it did break to a future tasking that we may or may not have. And so the force presentation adjustments in our reoptimization efforts is about a unit of action and about stitching together these disparate pieces that we pulled apart over the last 30 years for that strategic environment and bringing them back together into a unit of action that makes sense for the future strategic environment. And that unit of action is going to be the wing, combat wings and airbase wings and eventually deployable combat wings that we will present to the Joint Force as a whole entity. And much like the carrier strike group, which is presented to the Joint Force as a whole entity, if the Secretary of Defense elects to pull it apart to use it for different things, great, we'll execute that order. Just like we sometimes have two DDGs that go to CENTCOM while two or three remain in EUCOM. The Secretary of Defense makes that decision. The Navy sure does not like that, right? They want the whole capability to stay together, but they presented it as a whole capability. And the Secretary of Defense chose to pull it apart. Well, what we did over the last 30 years was pull it apart ourselves. So they didn't have to make that choice. Going forward, we want that to be a deliberate choice because there are implications to it. If you decide to use only a piece of the deployable combat wing, for example, you burn the other piece of the deployable combat wing, right? So if I take the C2 element out of a DCW and employ it, I still have that same window to move the cabs to a place if I chose to do so. And if the Secretary decided to do that, we could do it. But I don't have the DCW available in the next 6 months if I use one element of it. They have to go back into a reconstitution phase, which is really helpful when we can have that dialogue with the Secretary of Defense. I can say, I have 24 of these deployable combat wings. How would you like to use them? We recommend we divide them up, 6 per phase, and we have 6 available to you at any one time. You can elect to employ 8 if you like. But if you employ 8 in the next phase, I have 4 available to you. And that means that the 2 that you were planning to go to location X and location Y that we've already approved under your gift map orders are not going to be able to go there. And so it's your choice. We're completely unemotional, completely agnostic. We need to be able to have this conversation in a way that resonates with our joint service partners and leaders so that they understand the implications of the decisions that they're making. And we just have not been able to do that in recent years because of the way that we pulled ourselves apart to be as flexible as possible for the demands of the post 9/11 fights that we have been in.
So I hear you right. It's saying we've always been able to build menus of options for our bosses, but this is also going to let us better internally and then present to the senior leaders in OSD the readiness and the
risks as we look at various options they may choose, but we still have the option to be flexible on how we present forces. But this will be better to give them a composite picture for this different threat environment.
Yeah, this allows us to articulate capacity in a way that we couldn't before. It allows us to articulate risk in a way that resonates with not just the other services, but within our service. Force generation cycle allows me to say how much risk I am taking when you elect to deploy a unit in that cycle. If you take a unit that's in the reset phase, just got back from being deployed, and say, hey, this is, you know, I got a really big problem. I need to deploy this unit again. Okay, well, I can tell you exactly how much risk you're taking in the, because we're in the reset and because of where they just were and because of what they're going to do next. And this is a key element of this. You know, we only have so many resources. There's plenty of demand out there. Part of the AFWERGEN cycle allows me to say, hey, for the forces that I have available to the Air Force and that the Joint Forces requested, here's how I'm going to service your request. And that goes out several years. If you elect to do something different, an emergent task comes up and you go, hey, I need six more fighters, 12 more fighters. Okay, well, here are your options. I have 11 available fighter squadrons. All of them are committed to something that you've already tasked them with. The next fighter squadron that I have available is in 3 months, but they're in the certify phase right now. Your call if you want to use them for this thing that just popped up, or use them for the thing that they're supposed to go to in 3 months. Your call. There is some risk involved. They're not through the certification. They've gone through 9 months of training, so they're not ready. We can have a risk discussion there about what thing we're asking them to do. But now we actually get a trade between current and future readiness that is stark, right? In the past, it's been ephemeral. It's been this, well, this is going to be a risk to readiness. Well, this is actually going to hurt our readiness in the long run. Well, this is going to hurt our force structure, you know, theoretically down the road. Okay, how exactly? Well, hard to say exactly. Well, I don't know where that risk is going to be borne out. Now I can say exactly, this is the risk you're taking when you do this. This is the risk to your future force presentation plan if you do this right now. The Air Force is agnostic about which one you choose, but these are your options because here's how many I've got, and that's it. And we haven't been able to have the conversation that way in a number of years. Now, this has been ongoing specifically in the fighter community for about a year and a half. And we have had very good results working with the joint staff to adjudicate force posture and force allocation decisions in the Secretary of Defense's orders book over the last year and a half that have been very favorable to the Air Force, because I can now show them fully the risk that they're actually deciding to either take on or not take on. It's been very helpful.
So in some ways, we've been on a doctrine journey for a while, since now the chairman, but when General Brown was the chief of staff, he was from day one and even before that as the PACAF commander was basically, we need to basically update our doctrine to fully embrace the new realities where we've been used to fighting a certain kind of war in a certain kind of sanctuary for years and years. And now for this new great power competition environment, we're going to have to fight differently. And we're going to probably need a culture change as well, which really came out. And I noticed how important this was to him when I saw him at the Ash Carter Exchange in May. And he said he still talks to airmen as the chairman about mission command and the doctrine that we had put out on that is now brought into these documents with the ability to distribute and to be less, basically create greater targeting challenges to adversaries and to operate from various environments using basically the scheme maneuver we call agile combat employment. And I understand now that this was something that we've been trying to work into the culture. We've been experimenting, and it's now more the norm than it is the exception. Can you talk about what you've seen as far as the lessons learned regarding agile combat employment and how that enables and empowers mission command, which this doctrine is also meant to do?
Yeah, I think it's important we anchor on mission command for just a second and focus on the first word, the mission. You know, what mission do you have? Is it well understood? Do you understand the bounds of your mission? Has the higher headquarters commander, JFAC, JFC, given you direction and swim lanes to live within that you can exist, right? That you have the authority to deviate within. The essence of mission command is owning a mission. And if you don't own all the elements of the mission, you need to be very clear about that. You need to understand that as a subordinate commander. If you do own all the elements of a mission, you need to fully understand that as a subordinate commander. If you have all the tools at your disposal to use as you see fit based on commander's intent, great. If you don't, also great. But we want to build our teams to be able to do both. And I was able to talk with the incoming O6 command teams and leadership teams this morning and describe it is not a given that a JFAC is going to delegate all of the authorities that you may think you want as a wing commander. Let's call it in competition. Nothing's blowing up right now. Perfect comms. I'm able to manage the day-to-day C2 of forces at the AOC level and through the AOC director and the A3 and up to the JFAC, right? I'm probably not delegating you fires authority in that moment, right? Along the continuum of conflict, you know, there's a point at which crisis increases and indications and warning increase and we get into conflict. And even in conflict, I may not delegate all of those authorities to you because I'm still able to retain command and control from a CFAC level and decentralize the execution. And whether that's distributed control or in centralized command, we're certainly moving towards distributed control, just meaning that the node is more distributed and not centralized at the AOC. The function is the same. It, you know, and if it can reside at the JFAC level then or CFAC level, we want it to, right? Because they should have the most SA and the most input and influence on all of the forces, not just the forces that are in your sphere of influence or at your geographic location. Even in conflict, you may not get all of the delegated authority to do all of the things that you might be able to do given the resources that you have. But at a certain point, with mission command and commander's intent, if we are disconnected for a certain period of time, if we don't have follow-on orders that tell you how to project power to synchronize across the theater, if you haven't been able to make contact with your peers or your supervisors or your leaders between you and the JFC for whatever reason, there is a delegation of authority that may occur that allows you and probably should occur that allows you to take on more and more responsibility with the forces that you have available to you. And so I say all of that to say we need to train our commanders to be able to do both. I need you to take mission command with most of those delegated authorities restricted, not delegated, and execute and power project from your platform in concert with an AOC, an ATO, and JFAC direction. Or I need you to be able to take on delegated authorities to do all of the things associated with the joint warfighting functions at your location because you have the tools to do so. And I want the CFAC and the JFAC to have the ability to decide to delegate authority. Right now, we don't really have the tools at the wing level for wing commanders to take a delegated authority, even if I wanted to give it to them. They don't have the command and control tools. They don't have the protection tools. They don't have the intelligence tools or the information tools generally at their disposal. And part of what it is that we're doing with all of these reoptimization changes is to try to help build this unit of action into an echelon of command that can actually take on those warfighting functions if delegated. The delegation still has to occur from higher headquarters, and so that's up to them, you know, when and if they ever do it, based on conditions. Now, back to Agile Combat Employment and how that fits in that space. And so Agile Combat Employment is a scheme of maneuver. Obviously, it can be preemptive or reactive. It's important that the mission command discussion happen because it can be driven in exactly the way that I just described. It can be driven by the JFAC or it can be driven locally by local indications and warnings in concert with the JFAC and with their team. It was predominantly a survival mechanism early on in the early days of Agile Combat Employment. But very quickly, we realized, hey, we need to be able to aggregate offensive force from disaggregated positions in a deliberate way. And so Agile Combat Employment as a scheme of maneuver has taken hold in the forward theaters for sure. And the training to execute to those skills that are required to be effective in Agile Combat Employment are being promulgated throughout the Air Force to include service retained forces in exercises like Silver Flag, Bamboo Eagle, Agile Flag, et cetera. So, you know, there's a host of them. But Agile Combat Employment is a tool in our toolkit. I often said when we were first developing this in USAFE and F Africa, if I could protect the base, I would not have to ace, right? If I could effectively protect the base, all my resources are here. Why would I want to leave? Other than it creates a targeting problem. So yeah, there's some goodness there. But if I can protect the base, doesn't matter what the targeting problem is, or if it's just a small number of bigger targets, if I can protect it effectively, moving around just makes it harder for me. But when I can't protect the base effectively, and so there's an air base, air defense discussion that's a corollary to agile combat employment, you know, we have to get really serious in working with both MDA and our Army counterparts on air defense and what our role is in air defense and how the Air Force is going to provide some semblance of air defense for itself going forward. Because if I can build up some protection for some of these critical nodes, then the requirement to ace is not nearly as dramatic. And in fact, I might be able to ace for survival and then reaggregate back at the base that I left where all of our stuff is some point down the road if we're able to resource to that. But if I can't, then I have to do what we're doing right now, which is, you know, work on pre-positioning and work on schemes that allow me to disaggregate our forces for survival initially and then for effect to follow on with orders and commander's intent that follow the units that split themselves up and allow us to meet together in what the joint warfighting concept would call expanded maneuver concepts and in a pulsed kind of approach where I'd aggregate for lethality from my disaggregated positions across the theater, which is harder. It takes a lot more logistics tail to do it. It takes a lot more foresight and preparation to operate from multiple potential different locations without giving up the playbook to everybody ahead of time. We've come a long way. We still have a long way to go. It is better than just sitting and waiting to be attacked. There is no doubt. And will continue to be better the more that we resource it and the more that we defend our positions that we establish.
It sounds like you're saying there's no easy button, but we do have a good range of tools and techniques.
No easy
to give us options, and that's what we're working on now. So thank you so much. Again, appreciate the time you spent with us and sharing your insights as we follow the Chief's lead on this. Free play, anything else you'd like to basically get out to the force as we follow up on? These doctrine updates are meant to be tools that help people with problems and also to capture some of the things you've been talking about in an approved form that as we learn more, we'll update them and keep going. But thanks again for sharing your insights and wisdom. Basically, the last shots here, sir.
Okay, great. Thanks. Well, I appreciate the discussion today. Really important work that you all are doing here. I do encourage everybody to read the documents and understand what the baseline framework is that the Air Force is settled on for today. And as you mentioned, the intent at the LeMay Center is to make these into living documents as opposed to static documents that we refresh every couple of years. And come check with us in a couple of years. We'll get you a new update. You know, as things evolve and they're evolving more quickly than ever, you know, there's opportunity to give feedback to the LeMay Center to update the doctrine mid-stride and get that out to the force in a way that's predictable and deliberate. And so I appreciate you taking that on. That's really important. The other thing I'd offer to our to the listeners or to our airmen is that you're in a pretty exciting time for the Air Force. The things that we're doing now are not necessarily new things. They're not new concepts in many ways. In the Cold War, we deployed things called wings. We had garrison commanders, installation commanders that stayed behind and kept the base going while the operational wing went forward with that commander to fight. Or that was the plan, right? Obviously, there are limitations to that. You can't deploy a wing forever, right? So if you have a persistent requirement, you have to find a rotational scheme that allows you to provide coverage. And so that's what we've done in the Middle East. But we protected and we used camouflage, concealment, and deception our bases in the 70s and 80s in ways that are different than what we're doing today, but that we're getting back to, right? We're starting, you know, there were defenders that at one point carried Stinger missiles for air defense of air forces and air force forces. And so these things that seem like heresy are actually things that we've done in our past. The other thing that I would offer is that cognitively, we have to be prepared for the next fight. A fight against a peer is different than what we've been doing for the last 30 years. And our youngsters who are coming in today are coming in an environment where they know that. Yeah, they see that there is a peer adversary or a near peer adversary, and at least the technology is at parity in many cases. And what they're going to have to fight against, whether it's directly against the adversary or against their stuff, is going to challenge their dominance in ways that we just haven't experienced in the last 20 years. And we're going to have to be ready for fighting through the casualty rates that are going to be significantly higher than we've seen in the past and continuing to fight when and feed that fight, you know, sustain the fight with follow-on forces as units become non-mission capable for attrition, whether that's human attrition or aircraft attrition or weapons attrition. This is a different model than we've had to operate from in the last 30 years. So we have to mentally be prepared and get sets and reps through our training in the AFWERGEN cycle, which we are doing, and we're bringing elements of this into the training to prepare people for the eventuality that, hey, you're going to be running around on an airfield as a mission-ready airman doing multiple things to help launch aircraft while missiles are inbound, potentially, while there are explosions happening around your airfield, while you might be under a seaburn attack. These are all things that we have done before and we've trained to before and we know how to do, but some of it has atrophied and we got to get back to some of those basics that we used to train to routinely and prepare for routinely. And the fact that we're ready for it makes it less likely to occur, more likely to not occur. If we can make it an exceedingly hard problem, it is less likely to actually occur, and our adversaries will try to find other ways to achieve their objectives than the ones that might draw us into a direct conflict with them. And so we need their strength and we need their innovation, we need their ingenuity, and we need their intellectual curiosity to learn about how the Air Force is going to present and generate forces and how we are going to plan together going forward with our joint partners in ways that make us more and more lethal down the road. And that's the goal each and every day, is to increase our warfighting readiness and our lethality and ensure that the decision to go to war against us is one that is never made because our folks are ready to handle that situation if it were to come up. Thanks again for your time. Thanks again for the work here in the LeMay Center. Pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, sir.
That's going to do it for this week's podcast. The show is recorded, edited, and produced by the LeMay Center's Doctrine Outreach section. Special thanks to our guests, the LeMay Center, and Air University. As always, the views expressed by our panel members are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of Air University, the Air Force, or any government agency. Thank you, and we will see you next time.